And Bob Costas is a man who knows a lot about baseball, among other things. He is kind enough to join us this morning on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line here on the Fan, 680 and 93.7 FM. Bob, we do thank you for coming on the program.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Bob. Thanks very much. Listen, one of the things that you and I were texting about the other day is people are watching all these old games on YouTube and are trying to find networks and everything else. And the idea that Sandy Koufax and Mickey Mantle worked pregame for the 1969 World Series. There's mm-hmm. young versions of you showing up in some of these games as well.
But not in, not in 1969.
No, not that
not
young.
Not that early.
Yeah, not that young. But I do. We'll come. But that whole idea of knowing before you who some of the guys were who actually were part of these broadcasts for playoff games in baseball and the Super Bowl and those types of things. It is pretty crazy when you read some of the names.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't know why this example pops into my head, but a couple of years ago when I was lucky enough to be selected for the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame, a week or so later, I'm doing a game on the MLB Network with John Smoltz. And, of course, John was part of a team that produced five Hall of Famers, the top three in that pitching staff, he, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavin, Chipper Jones, four, and Bobby Cox, the manager, five. And it occurred to me just as I was sitting there and Smoltzy was congratulating me on what had happened the preceding week, five people that I overlapped with at NBC and worked with in one way or another are in the broadcaster's wing of the Hall of Fame. Joe Garagiola, Vin Scully, Dick Enberg, who did some baseball for NBC, my longtime partner Tony Kubek, and then last on that list, me. So you think about it, five Frick Award winners broadcasting baseball overlapping each other in the 1980s at NBC.
Bob Costas with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. You've done a lot, you've seen a lot, you've accomplished a lot. Can you compare what's going on right now to anything in your memory?
No, I think the thing that springs immediately to mind is 9/11, and as devastating as that was, and the ripple effects that it has, some of which we're still feeling today, the world, at least in America, began to return to something that approached normal not that long after. Our guard was up, we were still traumatized, but normal activities resumed. This is different. And nobody knows when the end game is or exactly what it looks like. You can't say, well, on July 1st, this will all be behind us. We don't know. So there's a sense not only of some dread, but also uncertainty.
Bob, when you were at Syracuse, and then you get the first job in the ABA covering the St. Louis mm-hmm. basketball team, what were you hoping for when you were at Syracuse? Like, if I would have asked you back then, maybe even after you get a paycheck, doing an ABA game, what were you really hoping for?
I was hoping to be someday the radio voice of a Major League Baseball team. And if I really had my druthers, it would be a team that had a tradition and history, played in a great baseball town and with a traditional stadium. And then perhaps in the off season, I would do what I was doing then, do pro basketball or college basketball. But I thought of my career as primarily headed in the direction of radio. And then things changed and fell into place.
Who's the first person to give you a job that was a step above maybe, and I'm not saying it wasn't a hell of a stepping stone. You're doing professional basketball games in the ABA, and there are certainly mm-hmm. great stories about that league. But who's the first person that either heard you, saw you, and said, okay, hold on, maybe this guy could actually do this or this?
Well, I guess there's several steps, but that pro basketball job was at KMOX in St. Louis. Still, but especially then, one of the premier radio stations in the country, back before cable TV, before the internet, before every team had a regional sports network, KMOX was a 50,000-watt powerhouse that on the right night could be heard in 35 or 40 different states. It wasn't just a St. Louis station. It was a regional station. It was the flagship of the huge and sprawling Cardinals radio network. Jack Buck was there. Harry Carey had been there. Joe Garagiola had been there. Joe Buck started his career there. Gary Bender, who had a fine network career, worked there. Dan Dierdorf worked there. The Mike Emmerich of his day, Dan Kelly, was the voice of the St. Louis Blues. They had a sports staff that could almost stock a network, and there I was, a 22-year-old kid who had been selected to join that staff. So that was really, in my mind, my most significant break. KMOX was a CBS-owned and operated station, which led the CBS network to have me do some regional games. And it was then, off those television games when I was 24, 25 years old, that Don Ohlmeyer, who then ran NBC Sports, spotted me. And he told me specifically that he wanted to hire someone under 30 who could grow into a variety of assignments. So then I found myself at NBC at age 27. So those two things are, I guess, the biggest stepping stones.
Is ignorance bliss at that point? You're so young, and back then, nobody that age was getting involved in the things that you were fortunate enough and talented enough to be involved with.
Well, Jim Lampley at ABC, although Jim wasn't doing play-by-play, he was doing a lot of hosting stuff, college football and whatnot, but he was around the same age. I wouldn't say ignorance, because I knew the history of broadcasting, and I had reverence for the history of broadcasting and for all the big names and legendary broadcasters who had preceded me and now were overlapping me. So I had a great sense of what was happening both at KMOX and at NBC, and a sense that I'd better at least be worthy of being the last guy in the lineup, that I had to step my own game up just to be worthy of being in their company.
We've been around radio for years. You started in radio, obviously, as well. As much as television gets credit and as fun as it is, I've got to imagine in the early days when you started at whatever station you were at, those were the times that you probably remember more so than anything else.
Partly because of youth, that's true. But also from the standpoint of the craft of broadcasting, radio is really it. And the great Vin Scully, who so often says it best, said that on television, your job is to put a caption beneath a picture that's already there. On the radio, they give you a blank canvas, a bucket of paint, and a brush, and you're responsible for painting the entire picture, the broad strokes, the little brush strokes. And then when the game is over, as he put it, you step back and hope that what you've painted is some kind of accurate and pleasing picture of the event you're broadcasting. So I've always felt that it was much more difficult for someone who started in television to go to radio than the other way around. In radio, you develop the full, and you use the full toolkit, so to speak. And then on television, you just have to adjust and pare it back a little bit.
Yeah, Bob, the other part about that is when you call games, there are some guys who say, that's what I do. I call games, and I'm hoping somebody hears me, and maybe I get to take this step and then this step. But the other part about your career is the conversations. There has to be a moment when somebody believes you're good enough at it, but you have to be interested enough to want to sit down with people and do, I guess we used to call them long-form interviews before there were podcasts. But the idea of the want to actually sit down with interesting people to try to have their story told in a way that is actually as interesting as you believe it is.
Interesting story behind that. I was doing a syndicated radio show. The radio landscape was much different then. It was on Sunday nights. Some 300 stations carried it, including most of the biggest stations in whatever city we were talking about. There was no Sunday night baseball. There was no Sunday night football. ESPN wasn't as all-powerful as it had become or would become. And so in that landscape, I did this show called Costas Coast to Coast. And David Letterman was driving down the road one Sunday night and listening to the broadcast. And the guest happened to be the great Packer quarterback, Bart Starr. And Letterman said to Dick Ebersol, who was so instrumental in my career and then was was not at that point running NBC Sports, but he soon would. He said something to the effect of, if Bob can make Bart Starr interesting for an hour, and I don't mean that as any kind of swipe at Bart Starr, but this is what David said. If Bob can make Bart Starr interesting for an hour, why couldn't he talk to just about anybody? And a light bulb went off in Dick Ebersol's head. And with the late, great Brandon Tartikoff, who then ran NBC Entertainment, he presented to him the idea of a late, late night show that would follow David Letterman's show. And that was the show you're referring to later, which ran from the late 80s to the mid-90s. And for much of that time, the lineup, talk about heady company, the lineup was Johnny Carson, David Letterman, and then my little show at 1:30 in the morning.
And the other part about that, you were on WSB here, and I've told the story. I was actually on Sunday nights at WSB, Flamethrower, same thing, heard in a whole bunch of states. And the impetus for this thing that I did called Hardball and some of the other things that Nick and I have said, and we were talking about it earlier today, whether it was Sir Edmund Hillary, whether it was Chuck, whether it was Jim Lovell, we realized, okay, we know our lane, well, why are we not speaking to interesting people? And that really, I'm telling you, that Sunday night was the reason. I've told the story. I wrote down 100 names back then when I was on the same night as you of people I think would be interesting enough to speak to. And I appreciate producers we've had here and the owners of the radio stations that have let us go do those types of things, which is not necessarily, quote-unquote, our lane.
Yeah, and outside of podcasts, Chris, you just don't see or hear much of that anymore. And it's gratifying, but also in a way frustrating, that so many people who are old enough to remember still mention those long-form radio shows and long-form television interviews that I did. Even the news magazines on television, not quite as long as a full half hour or full hour, but sometimes 15, 16 minutes to a segment. Outside of 60 minutes, that doesn't exist anymore. But I and many others used to do those. I did those on NBC in the 90s after I stopped doing later. I don't know whether it's the 500-plus station universe or the Internet or what people can get on their phones or whatever it is. People's attention spans are shorter, I guess, and the research that the networks do tells them that no matter how well done and no matter how interesting it might be to you and me, that there isn't as much of an audience for that as there once was. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's the prevailing wisdom.
Bob, we apologize. Because of the coronavirus outbreak, we were doing the show from my house, and I obviously have dogs, so pardon the interruption. I think Hank Weimeriner agreed with what you were just saying about the long-form interview. But with the podcast being so popular now, do you see radio going back to that?
Perhaps. My thought about podcasts, and maybe I'm just behind the curve here, is that it's a wonderful format, but it seems like this census, which we're in the midst of, the next census will show that about one in every five Americans has a podcast. And I'm sure that a lot of them are very worthwhile. But how can anybody make their way through the thicket of possibilities? I just wonder what the audience is. I know the people like Joe Rogan and Adam Carolla and others who do it on a daily basis. They have large audiences. But those who do it once a week or once a month, it just seems to me it's so narrowly focused, not the subject matter, but the audience that it could reach. You wonder whether you're just like, you know, it's the tree falling in the forest.
Yeah, well, the numbers will tell you it's over 800,000 now, and that's a lot of content. While the world is begging for content, there is that moment where you go, okay, how do I find it? And is the good stuff, some of it, slipping through the cracks? Before we talk about some of the people that you did have an opportunity to sit down with and become either friends with or media-related friends with, who are the guys you missed out on? Who are the women? Who are the people that you missed out on? They passed too soon. It was maybe something that was being worked on, but it didn't happen. Everybody seems to have a few of those.
That's a great question. We took a swing at, and I'm sure we were among thousands, nobody ever got to interview J.D. Salinger, the author of Catcher in the Rye. He was famously or infamously reclusive, wouldn't respond even to the most glowing of fan letters. He just walled himself off from the world. We tried. We didn't get J.D. Salinger. I interviewed Joe DiMaggio in other contexts, but I could never get Joe to sit down and do the full later program. Another person like that would be Sandy Koufax. You see what I'm getting at? We're looking for the people that virtually never did that kind of interview. Sandy Koufax, to this day, in his 80s now, looks like the handsomest man in the room, despite his advancing age. So classy. Anytime I asked him, he always personally got back to me and said, Bob, you know, I'm just not comfortable doing this, but if I ever did it, I'd do it with you, and which was awfully nice, but that didn't really, that was a nicer way of saying, yeah, you're first in line, but the line isn't going to move at all. so don't get your hopes up. But eventually I was able to pitch him when around an All-Star game in Cincinnati a few years ago, they had a fan vote and they selected the four greatest living players. And those players were Johnny Bench, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Sandy Koufax. And I said to Sandy, look, this is not going to be about you. You're going to be one of four people, and you're going to be talking about how your careers overlapped, except Koufax was gone a couple of years before Bench broke in, but essentially about your careers overlapped. And with that as the setting, out of respect for the other three guys, Sandy sat down and did it, and he was a wonderful storyteller with tremendous recall for details. But he's true to himself. He just doesn't want that kind of attention. So that was Captain Ahab and his whale.
Did you ever make a run at Neil Armstrong?
No. I don't know that the producers ever made a run at Neil Armstrong, but we did have Buzz Aldrin, who was more voluble than Neil Armstrong. Aldrin loved, I think Aldrin wound up going on Dancing with the Stars, you know. So we had Buzz Aldrin, and he was a good guest.
Bob Costas with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. We know about the Vince McMahon interview. Aside from that, and you know, Vince is going to play it up when he knows the cameras are on anyway. What was your most difficult interview? If that wasn't it, what was?
You know, people think that interviews that are contentious are the most difficult, and I guess they are if you don't know how to handle it. I've always felt that apart from those who are diehard WWF then and now WWE people who somehow think that the winner of an argument is the guy who can beat the other one up or yell the loudest, I think that for most people, I prevailed in that circumstance not so much because of content, because Vince isn't dumb, but because of tone. He lost it and I remained calm. But I really think, and I think you guys would attest to this, the most difficult interviews are not the ones that are contentious. They're the ones where the interview subject is just not forthcoming, where they're giving you short and uninteresting answers, and no matter how you try to come at it, you can't get them to open up. You can't get them to say anything interesting. I'd rather have a guy be in my face than somebody who's just, you know, on autopilot.
How about the idea of be careful meeting your heroes? Because that's another thing that people have, you know, we all get asked, hey, you know, just tell me, I won't tell anybody else, who's kind of a jerk? And that stuff sort of, even if you like somebody or believe they're interesting, and it, have you had a couple of those? And I'm not asking for names necessarily, but there are times that you might be disappointed in after meeting certain people.
You know, I thought about that question, and it's a very good question, but I was just tremendously lucky. No one who I would put in the category of someone who I would revere was ever a disappointment to me. And you start from this general truism. The people who made an impression on you when you were young, that always resonates more than someone who is comparable or in some objective way even better once you become an adult. So let's take baseball in St. Louis. I like Albert Pujols. He was a huge star with the Cardinals. I was happy to interview him. But it's not the same thing as interviewing Stan Musial, who comes out of your youth. I've interviewed Bruce Springsteen. Tremendous admiration, not just for his ability, but how thoughtful he is. Think of his autobiography, which is a doorstopper. Wrote it himself without a ghost. When you pose a question to Bruce Springsteen, he gives you a thorough and thoughtful answer. But as much as I admire him, that didn't register with me quite the same way as interviewing Paul McCartney. Because when Paul McCartney sat down, I'm thinking of being 11 years old and sitting on the floor of the living room with my parents on the sofa behind me, watching Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, and John Lennon for the first time on the Ed Sullivan Show on a Sunday night. So it's when you meet those people who seemed so distant, you'd never cross paths with them, you thought, as a kid. It's those people that resonate with you. And I can happily say, just confining it to sports, Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Sandy Koufax, whoever it might be, they were all not only polite and gracious, they were all wonderful to me personally. So I've never had that disappointment you talk about, although I know many people have.
Bob Costas with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. I would imagine the other challenge is an interview can be going too well. In other words, you're so encaptured, enraptured, whatever the term you want to use is, with the answers that you have to be careful not to lose your train of thought and think of the next question or react to what they're saying.
Yeah, but I've always felt that one of the keys to doing a good long-form interview is not to be locked into any specific plan. You want to do your preparation, but if you're determined to ask question four after question three, you're going to miss a lot of stuff.
Sure.
You don't know where it might go in an entirely unexpected direction sometimes. And you got to be prepared to go there as well. And if you do go there, it should be because it's so interesting. It doesn't matter what your plan was. This turns out to be better, at least for the time being. And then you can always circle back to where your preparation
Yeah, Bob, I agree. the idea of writing down questions is never, I don't even like to call them interviews because those can turn into depositions. I've always thought they're conversations. Somebody leans back in a chair because they realize this is comfortable. They move forward in their chair because they're about to tell you a story they haven't thought about in 15, 20, 25 years, or maybe never even have told. And in our world, when you can sense that, even through a phone line, in person it's much better, no doubt about it. But when you can sense that somebody is actually now engaged in a way that they might not normally be, it really is a home run. And look, I believe there are enough discernible listeners out there that know when those moments are actually happening.
I agree with that 100%. And I never wrote down questions. I'd write down bullet points, you know, name of a movie with an actor or the name of another person I wanted them to reflect on. But I never wrote out the question itself. The audience can tell that.
Bob, look, we ask about athletes and the talent. Some of it's God-given. Some guys work, and most guys have to work. If you're going to be great at anything, you do have to do the work. From an announcer's point of view, you mentioned a couple of guys earlier. I know what Nick feels. I know how I feel about who I think the best ever to come across on my TV, and part of it is maybe the age at which they did it. Do you believe that you have an idea of who some of the most talented actually were?
Sure.
Talented.
I wouldn't want to give a list because you leave people out, but let's start at the top of the mountain. You look at Vin Scully, and if he were a golfer, you would say truly that he had mastery of every club in the bag. Just start with the instrument itself. His voice is so distinctive, so melodic, so pleasing, that even when he's doing boilerplate stuff, stuff that in a transcript isn't particularly remarkable, it just sounds better. When he read the disclaimer and he broadcast reproduction, again, that sounded better than when the rest of us did it. Then on top of it, you have his pacing, his command of language, his frame of reference, which was obviously great when it came to baseball, almost 70 years with the Dodgers, so he'd witnessed a lot. But it was clear he was also a well-read man, not in a pretentious way, but his frame of reference was broad. He had all the qualities and all the talents and all the craftsmanship that you could possibly bring to bear, and he always prepared. It's one thing to have the talent. You can't rest on your laurels, though, and he learned that as a young broadcaster, as Red Barber's protege in Brooklyn, and Red was a tough taskmaster, and he made sure that the young Scully dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's before every broadcast, and Vin himself was fond of quoting the great actor of bygone days, Laurence Olivier, who said, you have to have the humility to prepare, and then the confidence to bring it off.
He made it sound effortless, and I think to me, Bob, that's the ultimate compliment.
You know, a lot of people think, and fine, they shouldn't have to analyze this that much, they think that broadcasting a sports event is easy, and they'll watch a three-hour game in which a very capable broadcaster gets it 99% right, and there's a slip of the tongue or a fact is slightly off. And especially now in a social media age, this guy is pilloried as a fool or an incompetent. I would ask the average person to turn down the sound on the television and just try and do a half inning. Or just try and call a few sequences at a basketball game. Go ahead and do it. See if you can have a good flow, no ums and ahs, get all the particulars right. Imagine a producer in your ear telling you a replay is coming or read this promo or we're going to a commercial or whatever it might be, juggling all that. I'm not saying it's rocket science, but it's much more difficult and entails much more than the average person realizes. But that's part of the art of it. If you make it look easier than it is, and if it's a comfortable listen for the viewer, then you've accomplished your job. You don't want him to see, you know, all the pulleys and all the things going on behind the stage. He just wants to see the show, and that's what you're obliged to give him.
Hey, Bob, a couple of minutes left. The Olympics, your admiration for the ones who are doing it when there's no cameras, the 4 years that we've talked about it, the Olympic trials are more gut-wrenching and more sort of, I can't believe 4 years, if I don't have a good day, if I don't have a good day today, I don't get to go. It doesn't matter. I've been number one in the world at anything.
Yeah.
How much do you appreciate the athletes who are doing it in places where there aren't cameras and there aren't microphones and all that stuff to get to those moments?
Well, that was the point I always tried to make over the course of all the Olympics that I hosted. It's unique in a lot of ways, but this is one of them. We pay attention in the United States to all the four major sports, let's say, that we follow. The difference between the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup Finals, the World Series, the Super Bowl is only a difference of degree. You don't have to tell the audience who Tom Brady is. You don't have to tell the audience, didn't have to tell the audience who Derek Jeter was. They know already. It's just that the audience expands as you get closer and closer to the end. But in the case of the Olympics, except for repeat bold-faced names like Michael Phelps or Usain Bolt or Carl Lewis back in the day, you know what that list is, the vast, vast majority of these athletes, not just Americans, but from the four corners of the globe, prepare in anonymity and then step onto the biggest stage in all the sports, often in events that are decided by milliseconds. So all that preparation, all of that sweat and toil, often comes down to just a moment, just one tiny moment. And that, I think, heightens the drama and the meaning of those events.
All right, Bob. Well, listen, we appreciate you coming on with us. Hopefully we could talk somewhere down the road because, as always, a lot of unfinished business with you, seemingly just scratching the surface. Bob Costas, again, a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks a lot, guys. Great questions. Have a good day and be safe.
All right, Bob. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
You do the same. Bob Costas joining us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line here on the Fan 680 and 93.7 FM.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Well, you know, story of my life.